All right, so I'm here with George Straden, author of The Secret Fire RPG. It's a book that's clearly modeled on old-school D&D, and I'm here to talk to him a few minutes about it. George, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Enrique. And I just want to have to mention that Enrique is a Star Wars fan, and I really appreciate that because that was the first game I ever worked on. And so we have something in common. So that was good to hear.
Oh, we have more in common, but I'll get to that
okay.
later.
Okay, oh, very good. Excellent, excellent.
All right, so George, why don't you tell listeners real quick about your love of D&D and how this started?
Okay, that's actually an excellent question. When I was nine, which was 1979, on Halloween, I vividly remember this. My friend and I had gone out trick-or-treating, of course, as you do when you're nine, and come back to his house for me to sleep over. Turned out his two older brothers had both also had friends sleeping over, so there were six of us. We were trading our candy, and they came and literally physically grabbed us. Like we were nine, and they were like 12 and 14, and dragged us down the stairs physically and told us we were playing D&D. And we're like, what is D&D? And this was, so in 1979, what you really had were the original three Little Brown books, the plus the supplements. Or... Yeah, exactly. But you also had the first basic box set, which was done by Tom Molde. It wasn't the red box, which was 1983. It was the...
The purple box?
It actually was. It was before that. It was a cover of... If you search online, you'll find it. It's a cover. It's a full color, four-color process cover painting of a dragon sitting on a treasure hoard with some adventurers coming in to fight the dragon.
Okay.
And if you see it, I think you'll be like, oh yeah, that's the picture.
And did you guys understand what you were doing? When
no, we sat down and we're like, what is this? And they're like, you're a dwarf. I'm like, is that some kind of comment on my height? Like, what? I don't know what's going on here. And they just said, shut up, you know, as older brothers do. Just do what we say. So for the first like hour or two, I was like, okay, we're going to... But I was getting more and more compelled with like, okay. Because we started out in town. I think we were playing Keep on the Borderlands.
As many people did when they
As it first started. And then after that, we played... Another person in the group had bought a copy that came with B1 in Search of the Unknown. So we actually wound up playing both. But in this case, we were playing Keep on the Borderlands. So we started in the keep. And I was like, what is this? Like, we're in a keep, and we're talking to people, and I'm buying gear. And, like, it was interesting, but I was like, I want to watch the animated Sleepy Hollow. You know, I don't want to be doing this. But as we got into the caves of chaos and started exploring around, like, I suddenly, it was like, my imagination just blew open. Like, literally, I mean, like, I didn't just suddenly become interested in what we were doing in the game. Like, my mind, like, there was an explosion in my mind that changed me forever, where my imagination just was running wild, and I was envisioning all these things they're telling me. And by the end of the game, I was so hooked. Like, I just found it so compelling. I remember, like, I didn't care that I was a dwarf anymore. I was happy being a dwarf, and the greatest thing that happened was that I came away from the adventure with a +1 dagger, and I was so excited. I mean, this is 1979, okay? That's how long ago this was. I remember it vividly. I was like, I have a +1 dagger. And now it's like 2 in the morning, like way past our normal bedtimes for a 9-year-old. And so we go to sleep, and my friend and I get up at like 8, because we're like revved to go, and like, we want to play again. So we go to the other brothers are now at the age of where they want to sleep in, and we're like, hey guys, can we just borrow the set? We want to play. They're like, no, you can't play. You can't use our game. And we're like, oh, come on. And so, of course, they don't let us use their game. So we go scouring through the game sets that our friends had, like pull out Monopoly, get the dice out of that. Go to Yahtzee, get the dice out of that. We just found as many six-sided dice as we could. We just started making up our own game. I mean, we knew the heck we were doing. We didn't have a DM. We were just both players, and we're just 1-3 you hit, 4-6 you miss. Okay. And just running around like, okay, we'll run into orcs. Okay, cool. And we didn't even have character sheets. We didn't know what we were doing. Like, we were just enjoying that sense of what always stayed with me, which is what makes me go back to the roots of D&D, which is this sense of exploring the unknown. And I just, that to me is just so much fun, and you know, having randomized dice adds to that, because you don't know what's going to happen. So that was what got me into it, and I was from then on hooked, to the point where even though I went to college for, when I went to college, there were no such thing as game design classes. There was no, you know, couldn't take it. But I played all the way through. I played first edition. I've always played first edition. I loved first edition because there was something about it that captured that feel. And I'm not to say that it was perfect. And I think Gary Gygax, well, in fact, I know, he said, you know, it wasn't perfect. But the heart of it was there. And then I also played second, third edition. In fact, I wrote a 3.5 book, and I played fourth edition as well. In fact, I was a playtester for fourth edition because all of my friends... who worked at West End Games with me, which where I worked full-time for 3 years, had gone over to TSR at the time, where it still existed, and then, obviously, WotC, Hasbro, 4th edition. So I got to play test it for a year in advance, and then I did I was a consultant on the DMG 2 for 4th edition, and so I played all the different editions of the game, but I never stopped playing 1st edition. I've always had a 1st edition campaign going, just because of the flavor of it. But what I started doing is writing this blog, saying, well, you know, I love 4th edition, but there's some things that I do in my 1st edition game that I wanted to bring over, so I tried to figure out ways to incorporate that. So I came up with these little house rules. So I started, you know, I had the blog kind of going, and I was just talking about random things. Sometimes I talk about screenwriting, and sometimes I talk about, because that's my day job, let's call it. And sometimes I talk about movies I saw, or like movies I saw and hated, and how I would have done it, you know, or something like that. Or sometimes a movie I saw and I loved. But then I started talking about, oh, well, in 4th edition, I run a 4th edition game. I still run a 4th edition game right now. In fact, I run it by Skype. Like, I moved from L.A. recently back to New York because I had enough of L.A. And I was there for 8 years, but I had a group there, and I started just, you know, writing down on my blog things that we tried in 4th edition to see how they would work. And some worked, some didn't work, but it was all geared around taking that spirit that Gary Gygax had and incorporating it into 4th edition. Which 4th edition had all these great mechanics, really right. Cool, interesting stuff you could do that
simplified
made
mechanics.
Yeah, and really made monsters easy to run. I felt it was the easiest game to run as a DM in terms of having a set of mechanics that were very clear.
Absolutely.
And you could just make up stuff on the spot.
I feel the same way. That's why I started my blog, because I did.
I feel like it's the easiest version of D&D.
Easiest D&D to run as a DM. Absolutely.
As a DM, yeah. I totally agree 100%. Yeah. So. But I wanted to make sure that I added in this, you know, this spirit of exploration, because what I did find was that some players kind of would miss out on that because they'd be very buried in like their character sheet and their powers and whatnot, and forget about some things. And the game doesn't preclude
not to take the interview in a different direction, but yeah. I think a lot of that had to do with the presentation, the way the game was presented.
And I actually wrote a blog about that exact topic. I said it's not about. The game doesn't preclude you from acting that way.
It's the way the game was presented to people.
Yeah. It was a little bit too light on the narrative and the ideas behind it.
Absolutely.
So, and I wrote about that. And in fact, Andy Collins was a good friend of mine, and he was one of the developers of 4th Edition. And he asked me to read over the DMG 2 because they realized that it had done that.
Right.
And so the DMG 2, in fact, by the way, everybody, it's a great book because they tried to bring that into the game and give you a lot of options and hints and ideas of how to incorporate that and encourage people to get, you know, that side of the game there, because it works in the game. You there's no reason you can't play it that way.
Yes.
So, but I started putting in my little, like, what I try to do is come up with mechanics that encourage that spirit. So not just say, like, you guys should role play. You know, not just saying, just go role play. It's like, how can I come up with a mechanic that incentivizes you to role play? And so I'd come up with these little things here and there, and I'd post them, and I'd be like, oh, that really did not work. My players did not like that one bit, so I'm ditching that. Or it led me to another idea that's better, and we're using that or whatnot. So I actually started making a list of the house rules that worked. So we had like 10 or 11 house rules that we used in our 4th edition campaign, and eventually I started thinking, you know, I haven't designed a game in a long time, because I worked for West End for a while, and I did freelance for a while after that for WotC and for various game publishers. And but in the meantime, I had become a screenwriter, and which was great because it tied in with my background as a fantasy, because I worked on Hercules and Xena, and I worked on this Dragonlance movie that I'll just say right off the bat, like, was not happy with the way it turned out. So
yeah, I don't think too many people are.
Yeah,
it doesn't say anything about the writing of it, though.
And actually, I got some really good feedback from Margaret and Tracy, and for me, the success on my side was pleasing them, and they even did some interviews where they had some great quotes that I just, like, I keep, because the fact, and I was a huge, and have been a huge fan of those books since they came out in mid-80s, and the last thing I want to do is displease Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I spent a lot of time with them beforehand trying to understand. I read the Annotated Chronicles, which are great, because I wanted to get into their mind. Well, because I had to cut, because their books are long.
Obviously, you always got to make some.
So I had to make choices. So I wanted to see what was important to them. And then I got was able to actually speak to them, which never happens in Hollywood. You never get to speak to the author of the book. So it was great. It worked out great. And they felt that the vision in the script that I turned in was their vision for the book, and with the understanding that I couldn't fit everything into it. So, but the way, you know, you're the screenwriter, so you... I'll wait till that screeching stops. Yeah. So you lose control very quickly as a screenwriter. So, you know, that kind of led me to screenwriting, and I did that, focused on that a lot, but still played D&D. And then I was like, you know what? I haven't worked on a game, and I had been asked to come to Gen Con as a guest of honor to talk about screenwriting and how do you get into screenwriting. And I said, you know what? That's a sign. That's a sign that I should take all these notes that I had. I had notes all over the place. And that was coupled with another thing that happened, which was Gail Gygax asked me to work on this movie with her about Gary Gygax. And she literally gave me thousands of pages of notes about Gary and how he developed D&D in the first place, written in the early 60s well before it came out. So I read thousands of pages of notes.
That's like a geek treasure trove.
It was. I literally was like, my managers were like, you know, this is going to take a long time. Like, we'd rather you work on this dumb Hollywood action movie instead. And I was like, no. I don't care if this movie never comes out, or I don't care what happens to this movie. I want to work in this movie because... I'm a passionate D&D player, and I'm a huge fan of Gary Gygax. I would love just the opportunity to read this material, and I told Gail all that too. She knows, and she's great. I love Gail. She's the sweetest person. She's very smart and very savvy, and so I got this chance to read what Gary's mindset was, and not just like the way he developed mechanics, although that was there, but why he developed the mechanics that way, and why he developed the game. And I'll give you one example: is that he had a whole section on, he wanted a game that was cooperative play. So he was a big chess player, he played cards, he played war games, people know that, I think. A lot of war games, and there's always a winner and a loser in all those games. And he was like, there's got to be a way to do a game that is fully cooperative. Like, even the DM, in his view, was not against the players. And he constantly tried to make that clear to people, right, in especially in the DM Guide 1, like, very clear, like, you are the facilitator. Yeah,
you're collaborating with the players.
Collaborating with the players. So there's no winners or losers. So that was one of his big things behind writing it, which he never actually really talked about, like, as an inspiration, like, personal inspiration for writing the game. And I was, like, blown away. And, like, reading through these things, and the way... I'll give you one other example, just because I think it's just cool. He was reading something, and it came across this term, platonic solids. And he's like, what are platonic solids? And honestly, I have to say, like, I went to college, and I, you know, don't feel like I'm a dumb person, but I'd never heard of platonic solids either. So I was like, oh, let me just Wikipedia platonic solids. I Wikipedia it, and the first thing comes up is all the dice from D&D. Because platonic solids are three-dimensional polygons.
Okay.
A triangle becomes four-sided die. So they took all these polygons, different sides, and turned them into the dice, and literally what you're looking at are the dice for D&D with no numbers on them. So Gary said, oh my god, I mean, we're talking far before anybody had access to computers on a daily basis, right? 1960s. So he said, I can have random number generators and not just use D6s. Because D6s were available, they were around. Craps, I mean, like, from time immemorial.
Monopoly.
Monopoly, Yahtzee, and wargaming. He's like, I want something different. I'm like, oh my god, I can make random numbers of 1 to 4 and random numbers of 1 to 12. 1 to 20.
That is very... I don't think I've ever heard that
before. No, I didn't. I never heard it. I never heard it. And, like, literally, Wikipedia, when you get a chance, it's the first thing that comes up, a picture of those without numbers on them. So I found it compelling. So what was great was, in designing The Secret Fire, I started with... So that was the impetus for me of saying, look, this is a sign. These two things have happened at the same time, which is roughly about 6 months ago or so. And I had 10 pages of notes, and I've been playtesting those notes technically for the last, you know,
so
10 or 11 years.
The home rules you were using in 4E?
Yes.
Sort of bled into this game that you designed?
Yes, and I was also running a 1E campaign. So I had a 1E campaign going and a 4E campaign going.
Okay.
And what was great about it is I could see the differences constantly. I was constantly reminded of what was great about this game, version of the game, what was great about this version of the game. And I thought, you know, if we could couple what's great about these two versions of the game, we'd have an amazing game here. So I always had that in my mind, and I was like, one day I'm going to do that. But I was always so busy, and we get busy with things, and, you know, you just don't get around to doing things.
Right.
But when I got the call to come to Gen Con, and I got this movie where I got access to Gary's original material, I just said, that's it. That's a double sign that I need to do this game. So I took all the notes and collected them and made them readable and usable and playtestable in a wide scale. Because literally they were like notes I made to myself. So I did write them out, not in a final format, but in a way that people could read and run it. And the last stage was then writing it so people, it was presentable.
So one of the things, I have the book. I read through the book.
Great.
One of the things that stuck out, and it immediately stood out because it's very different from the norm today, is players are not average. Players are not
superheroes.
Are not superheroes or average Joes.
Yes.
Why'd you go with that philosophy?
I did one with that philosophy for a very specific reason. Once I decided to do it, I started out by writing a list of design principles, what I wanted to see in the game, and one of them was that. I love Star Wars, and we talked about this. We're not talking about the game. I'm talking about the movie. So the original Star Wars movie came out when I was 7, and I was enthralled. And this was the time and age of you can actually go to a drive-in theater.
Right.
So I saw that movie 7 times at a drive-in theater, and going to see a movie multiple times at that time was unheard of because it was the first big blockbuster. I mean, actually, that's not entirely true.
Jaws
was the first
before,
big blockbuster in 75.
Yeah.
It's the second big blockbuster. But I was 7. I was too young to see Jaws. So for me, it was their first big blockbuster with Star Wars. And I love the idea of a farm boy, just a regular Joe.
Zero to
average
hero.
Guy. Zero to hero. That's perfect. I love that. I never heard that before. Who, by the court, going through all these trials and tribulations of being a human being, a regular human being, became a hero. And that made me feel, as a 7-year-old, like, I could do that. Whereas when I saw superheroes, I was like, well, I don't have super strength, and I don't have invisibility or, you know, whatever. I can't be this person. I enjoy reading comics, and I enjoy it. It's not that I didn't enjoy it, but I didn't feel I could be part of that world.
Right.
Whereas with Star Wars, I felt like I could be part of this world. And, like, literally, as soon as Splinter of the Mind's Eye came out, because Empire was a long way away, I was like,
Alan Dean Foster.
Sorry, yes. I speak to you because I know you know it, but probably fans don't know it. But Alan Dean Foster wrote this great book.
That's the first expanded universe novel in the Star Wars universe.
In the Star Wars universe. I encourage you to read it because you'll see what was happening at the time with Star Wars, actually. It's very interesting. In fact, the Kyber Crystal, which is one of the big, like the MacGuffin, Hitchcock MacGuffin of the book, was actually originally in the movie. So you know that. Right. And
that was part of the script, the Kyber Crystal.
Exactly.
I think they powered the Force or something.
They powered the Force, yeah. Exactly. So Alan Dean Foster had all these various drafts of the Force, and he took these pieces that weren't used and put them together. So I read that, and I'm like 7, 8, no, I guess I must have been 8 by that point, by the time that book came out. Because first they put out the novelization of Star Wars, and then the second book was the Splinter of the Mind's Eye. And at 8 years old, I'm reading a book, and it wasn't written for kids. It was written for, you know, everybody. So some of the things I didn't understand and whatnot, but I just loved it so much. Like I was just immersed in that world, and it felt like a real world to me, and a world that I could be a part of, and I could become a hero. I could become a Jedi Knight. You know, like, I could be a Jedi Knight. And, like, I wonder if we do have these powers. Like, I'm 7, you know? I'm, like, walking down the hallway in school going, like, trying to use the Force to move, you know, the garbage can, you know, stuff like that. Like, and I really was trying to do it. I swear to God, I know that sounds ridiculous, but
I don't think you're the only kid who's ever tried to do it.
Okay, so it's great. So that's why I love that feel, and I wanted to bring that back, this sense of, like, I could do this too. And I'll make a little tangent here very quickly to show how I brought that idea fully into the real world. There's an appendix in the book called The Adventure Continues, and between sessions of playing the game, playing the Secret Fire, you can do works of charity, acts of kindness, self-improvement things you always want to do. And these are things that everybody wants to do. Everybody wants to make people feel better and do charity work or whatever. And I give it just a list that's a non-exhaustive, just ideas that you get points for doing. So it's like, I'm out and this is real life, right? I'm out in real life, and if I do this thing, I'm going to get a point, too. That's kind of cool. And then when you get to your next session, you add up all your points, and let's say it adds up to 10. That's the percentage bonus of XP you get for that session.
Interesting.
So it's a little incentive to remind you, like, I know I want to help this. I want to mentor a young kid, or I have a cousin. I have a nephew, and I know he needs help with math, and I'm good at math, and I always want to help him, but I... You know, all our lives are so crazy, but I remember now, I get some points for doing that. And it's not, I'm doing it for the points, but it just reminds you that, like, yeah, I did want to do that. So, and hey, I get a bonus. I get 2 points in my next game session. That's cool. So everybody win. It's a win-win. Like, the kid's going to love the fact that, like, my older, you know, uncle is going to come over and, like, help me with my math, you know, which I hate, but he's going to help me understand it. And that's cool. And I think people will get something out of that. And that's being a real-world hero. And I wanted that. So that's just a little slight tangent, but it's within the whole game, and it was very important to me, so I'm really glad that you actually picked up on that.
So if I'm a new player to the Secret Fire, and I scroll through the book, what am I seeing? Tell me the Secret Fire.
Okay, so I think there's two types of new players. So there's the new players who've never played any role-playing games before, and there's the new players who played other types of role-playing games before. So I'll start with the latter. So let's say you played D&D before. That's a classic game. Well, I have to say that's probably the most popular.
That's a gateway role-playing game
for most people, at least. So you'll see a lot of things that you are expect. And
now let's be clear though. This book is not based. It's not a retro clone.
Correct. And it's not OGL.
It's a new, entirely new system.
Entirely new system. Works on its own.
Inspired by
not only that, but you know, all my work on the Star Wars games, and I worked actually on the Lord of the Rings game for Decipher, which unfortunately was not long lasted. I wrote 2 books for them, and only one came out before they were. When they lost the license or went out of business or whatever happened. And I worked on a lot of games that were based on movie properties. So it was a lot, like Men in Black, for example. So it was trying to figure out how do you take storytelling and imbue it into a game. So because that's what people are expecting. So it's got the tropes of classic fantasy role-playing. So we're going on adventures. The adventures could be for treasure. They could be quests to save a princess. They could be anything that you want them to be. And you've got a group of people who have assembled together as companions, and they each have different skills. So, you know, those are the things you expect out of a role-playing game. I think if you didn't have those things, people would be kind of annoyed with it. So that to me is fun, though, all those things. So those are all in there. And then what makes it different, and I think what should be, and two things that would be very noticeable to new players is, number one, I don't know if you had a chance to look at the character sheet, but on the character
sheet. I did. The character wheel. The character wheel that you color in.
You color in. So that's one of the first things, and I often find that people who mention that, like, sit down at a table, I playtested it all over the world. I went all over the U.S., I went to London, Paris, Edinburgh, all over, wherever I could go, to get people's reactions, and wherever I went, there'd always be somebody who'd say, "What's this?" Immediately. They sit down at the table.
It's the focal point of the character sheet.
And it's on purpose. It's on purpose. And it's very visual. And for people who haven't seen it, you can download it for free from the site. In fact, I meant to put it up there. I think it's there, but if it's not, it'll be up there by the time you hear this. I put it there in the center and made it big on purpose. And I included things in there that were from different cultures, too. There's an Indian influence. It's like actually a mandala from the Indian influence, Eastern influence. And then there's the Greek symbols of the zodiac are in there. And so there's polygons of all sorts in there. these people who sat down and said, "What is this thing? I want to know what this is," were all visual people. In fact, they're literally like visual artists or studied art history or something, and I wanted that because it was meant to be that on purpose, a visual. Because usually a character sheet is all literary, like numbers, or it's math and words.
It's a bunch of stats.
And then
there's a token character drawing box at the top.
If you can draw, and for me it's a stick figure.
Yeah.
So I wanted something that really captured your attention. And what it is, what it represents, is your life essence. So, like, you know how you meet somebody for the first time, you get a vibe from them. There's, like, an energy that comes to you. It's like, and I hate to use the word aura because I feel like that has, like, connotations of new age-iness, and it's not that. It's just, like, you meet somebody and you go, like, "Well, that person's an angry person," or, like, "I meet that person, well, that person's a very sweet person." You know, you just get that energy from them. So I was like, how do I do that in a game? Because, you know, we're all players sitting around, but we're not our characters, we're ourselves. So it's, unless you're a great actor, it's going to be very difficult to put off that aura. So how do I do that in a way that's non-intrusive, like doesn't pull you out of the game, and is interesting, and you can glance and get it in 1 second? So what that character wheel represents is the 5 primordial forces of the universe, and the 5 are run quickly through: our life, death, the great unknown, the elements, and the void. And I can explain them all, but some of them are very clear. Life, death, you kind of get what those are. Great unknown is all the things that we don't know about. And still, in real life, you know, scientists every year, like, revise what they told us last year. You know, there's all the stuff that's unknown, and it's compelling. Like, what's out there? You know, what's around the next corner? And people go on exciting trips and, like, backpack through Europe or whatever, because it's partly because it's unknown. It's not familiar. Like, it's an adventure. That's what an adventure is, like, going into the unknown. If you know exactly what's going to happen, it's not so much an adventure, you know? It's not as fun, I find, anyway. And the other one that I think that's the one that's a little bit more difficult to explain is the void, and that really came from Eastern philosophies. And really what it means is... my phone has gone off. What it means is the void is the thing out of which everything else comes and to which everything returns.
Okay.
So, it's explained in the book, so I won't take up time really going into it, but it's in the book, more detail on that.
So the way I visualize it at the table, a character sheet would have a multicolored circle in the middle of it.
Exactly.
And from what I understood reading the rules, based on challenges the character faces that deal with those certain aspects, he would color in his character sheet.
Exactly. So what happens is...
So you could tell if someone has faced... So if someone is, I'm elemental fighter, I've fought many elements, I would see his element circle colored in, and I automatically know, well, this guy...
You totally got it.
Okay.
That's exactly it. And you can... Okay. And all of those different forces, these forces can be good or bad.
Right.
Right? So that also could be... Let's just take the same example. So red is death in the game. Okay. And by the way, when you fill in your mosaic, it's got, I think, something like over 80 polygons, discrete polygons and circles and, you know,
can squares. Can I choose my colors, or are the colors predetermined?
The colors are predetermined for a reason. I'll explain why in 1 second. But where you color in is not. You okay. choose. So if you think, I just went on this adventure, and so... You get every time you level, you start with a certain number, but every time you advance in level, you get two more rank. We call them ranks in the elder in these elder forces. You get two more ranks. One selected by you as the player, and it should relate to the biggest event that happened between the last level and this level, and one that I choose as, we call it the game master, the master creator,
master
the MC, which MC also meaning, you know, the entertainer for the evening, because I wanted to convey that too, that you're the entertainer for the evening, you're not against the players, going back to that Gary Gygax model. So that was very purposeful. So you may say, like, I died during the adventure, so, I didn't go around killing a lot of things, but I died. I'm going to give myself a rank in death, because that was a horrific event I went through, and I feel like my character's, you know, kind of scarred by that. So I'm going to give myself a rank in death. And I may say, as the MC, that's great. You know, I would never stop you from your pick. Like, your pick is your pick. But I get to make my pick, and I might agree with you and say, I give you another one in that, so you add two. But I might say, you know what, though? I think what was more interesting about it is that when we played out that part, everything is immersive, so there's a lot of role-playing going on. We've role-played a little bit about you dying and kind of going into the afterlife, and your characters, your allies, bringing you back, and we talked about how your spirit was being pulled, and you were feeling this energy. So actually, I'm gonna give you a rank in the great unknown, because you've gone into the great beyond. So I'm going to give you a rank in the great unknown, because I think that is, I mean, who gets that chance? And you know more about the great unknown now than people who haven't had that experience. So, okay, cool. All right, so now you add a rank. There's a space to include how many ranks you have. And those come into play. Those numbers come into play. But you also color in. So we get one, red is death, and green is the unknown. Now, the importance of keeping the colors purposeful. And you can say, like, okay, I agree that I, you know, was part of the great, the great unknown, but... It, for me, I don't feel like it's like that big of a deal as dying. So I'm going to pick a big polygon to make red and a smaller one for green.
For green.
So that's totally up to you. So how much does it mean to you and your character? So that's your choice. So you can play things down, play things up, however you want to do based on this character wheel. But what's important about keeping the colors the same is that I can sit there as a player or as a master controller, a master creator, and just glance around the table. And I can't read your sheet, like, from across the table. I just can't. It's too small. It's handwritten. Most of us don't have good handwriting skills, unfortunately. But what I can see, because it's so big and it's in the center of your sheet, is your character wheel. And what I can see is the colors on the character wheel and how much of each color you have. So I could look, as you were saying, just by a glance, I can see you have a lot of red on your sheet. So you have a lot of experience with death. And I don't know if necessarily that means that you've been killed or if you've killed a lot of people. And I don't know if that necessarily means that you've like gone berserk and like gone crazy.
But certainly death surrounds you.
That surrounds you, and you know about death.
Okay.
And somebody else knows a lot about the great unknown. And it's just, and we're just picking up, you know, it's the a way for the characters to pick up on the aura or the, I like the word vibe, the vibe of the other characters instead of, you know, you having to try to, I mean, that's hard to role play, like an aura of a person. And I think great actors can do that, but it's difficult. And they have so much, they have camera angles or they have spotlights or different colors. There's ways for that to happen that, you know, they have all these advantages to do that. Sitting at a table with a bunch of people is difficult. But now there's this thing, you don't have to do anything. Your vibe is there on your sheet, and people can just look at it anytime they want and go like, oh yeah, he knows a lot about death.
Yeah, I found it to be a very interesting mechanic. Certainly, I had never seen any game that actually did that.
Cool. I was looking, I want something, I was like, how do you do that?
I may be wrong, but that's the first time I see
it. I haven't seen it either, so.
I thought it was really interesting.
Thank you very much. Mechanic. So, and just to add a little bit onto that, where the numbers come in, the ranks, there can be certain situations where those numbers come into play. So, for example, if you go into a room and a massacre took place in the room, it's imbued with the essence of death. So you may walk into the room and have all this, you know, all these ranks and experience in death, and that could mean, usually there's a role associated with it.
Okay.
It could mean that because you have a lot of association with death, that you come into the room and you are like overwhelmed because you're so attuned to death that you just like you start seeing the massacre happening in front of your eyes if it's happening right then and there, and you're like freaked out by it. Or it could mean that everybody else is really weirded out by the room because they have, you know, lots of points in life or whatever, but you are able to, you know, deal with the room even though it's imbued with this, you know, darkness of death because you're so used to it. So each room is different, depends on what happened in the room, but those ranks that you've earned can come into play in other situations.
Okay.
So in like somebody casts a spell against you, a spell of death, you might get to add your ranks in death to, you know, prevent the spell from affecting you, just as an example. So they do factor into other parts of the game, but it's really there to give everybody the essence of the characters.
I want to touch a little, another aspect of the game now, and that's the business side of it.
Yes.
Because I know that this game was financed via Kickstarter.
Yes.
And we're seeing a lot of games using Kickstarter as a new way to get games out there.
Yes.
And I see a future where one day not only are books and games being published via Kickstarter, but amateur filmmakers are putting their films out via Kickstarter as well.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about your, and I mentioned films because I know you have a background in film, and yes, film is something I want to touch on with you later.
Great.
But tell us about your Kickstarter experience.
It was great. In fact, somebody else told me about it. I had never heard of it, and I went to the site, and I was like, this is fantastic. What a great idea. I don't know who came up with this idea, but it's a fantastic idea. I mean, Kickstarter provides this service where you can raise funds for a project. It can't be like a company or a charity. It has to be a project.
Independent projects.
Projects, which is great, because those are the people who need it most. The people there are fantastic, and they're so down to earth and relaxed. Like, I got an email one time from somebody there. He's like, oh, hey, dude. And I was like, wow, that's very relaxed, you know? And so they've been great people, really easy to work with. The way that the site is set up is so simple. It makes a lot of sense. Clearly, they put a lot of thought into it. And you can go out and it's like, you know, it reminded me of PBS when they have these fundraisers. And what they provide you with is a token of appreciation. Like, you give $50 and you get a tote bag that you're never going to use. You know, it's great that they give you a tote bag. That's totally nice. You know, but the point is, you want to donate to this cause or to this project and feel like you're a part of it. And what you don't normally get in Kickstarter is a tote bag. What you get is behind-the-scenes access or some cool thing where you get your... In my case, I had one option was you get your name in the book or as a patron. Like, and that means that you enable this book to be created. Like, let's say you're not necessarily a creator, but you want to create something. This is your way of getting involved in... every single person who contributed to my book...
Is
invested in the book and is also a creator of the book. They should take pride, like, in feeling like that's part of what they did. Like, they caused it to happen by generously, especially in this time period that we're in with the economy. And, I mean, the things going on in the last 2 days and that to be willing... I just feel so, you know, blessed every time somebody donated to the cause. And I'm not giving them you know, it's not a transaction like a store where I'm giving them the exact value of what they've given me. I'm just giving them a small token of appreciation for this generous donation. They could give me nothing. Like, there's no reason for them. But they see what I'm trying to do, and they believe in what I'm trying to do, and they support it. And I love that. It's like they're patrons of the arts. I feel like in Kickstarter, most of the things are art-related.
They are.
And I've started to see films, like you said, like short films, and now even for features up there. And it's so great. I mean, I just think it's a new way of empowering people who can make great films but can't get access to, like, the Hollywood system. And I am very familiar with the Hollywood system, and it is very difficult to break into the Hollywood system.
Absolutely.
And it's very unfortunate. And so these stories that can make us all feel better or learn something about life, we'll never get to see, because the studios just, you know, want to make money, and that's a niche project. We need to sell, you know, 100,000, you know, more than that, 100,000 tickets at least on an opening weekend, or this isn't worth doing. This way you could put out a movie through whatever distribution channel. Like, I think eventually you'll have great distribution channels and make Netflix that are for new movies that you don't see the theater. And I actually think theory of what's going to happen. I'll make a prediction. Eventually, you're going to have movie theaters that show these films that don't go through the traditional channels of big studios.
Well, it's cheaper for them too. They don't got to pay the
fee to the studio. They pay opening weekend.
That's why you pay $15 for a tub
for
of popcorn.
A Coke. Yeah, exactly. Because they on opening weekend, which is the biggest weekend of, you know, Captain America or whatever big new huge movie. They only get, the theater gets 20% of that. That's the average. And the studio gets 80. And then over time, each week, the numbers go down. And, like, so by week 10, the theaters are getting 80%. By week 10, that's still the equivalent of just getting 20% from week 1.
And then when you got studios forcing the theater owners to upgrade to 3D and...
Upgrade to 3D. And also on top of that, they'll say...
The digital projection and all that.
All of that. And they'll also say, we're not giving you... We have... We know we have this great movie. We've got Captain America. We know everybody wants it. We also have three crappy movies. We know they're crappy.
You have to take our three crappy movies.
Studios and they're forced to do it. So what I think this is going to enable eventually, I don't know when, but actually forcing the theaters to put in digital projectors, I think is actually going to help this indie world of filmmaking. Because
they stream the movies.
Yeah. It's going to be great. So I actually think we're in a great time period for filmmakers, as well as anybody who wants to make a game or a novel or anything. Go to Kickstarter, set up your account, explain what you want to do, give access to behind the scenes of the creation process, ask people for input. People have great ideas. People who think they're not creative are actually creative. They just don't know it.
There's a lot of games coming down the pipe that were funded by Kickstarter, and you're seeing it more and more.
It's great.
You're seeing it more and more. There's one game that I don't know if you're familiar with it, called Bulldogs.
Yes.
That was absolutely fully funded through Kickstarter. It looks like it's such a fun game, and absolutely, I haven't had a chance to play it yet.
I haven't played it either, but it's
basically the Han Solo RPG, where you're flying around in a space transport, you know, smuggling and delivering things or whatever.
Which is great. You'd have to go to a game company, try to get them to buy your game and get them to... And it's great, and especially with the other part of that is like things like Lulu, where you don't have to do a print run of a minimum of 10,000 copies, which you got to pay for up front, and then store somewhere in a warehouse. The investment is huge. So with things like Lulu and the other variations of that, you can literally...
And just to be clear, Lulu's a print-on-demand service that you can upload your book and someone can go buy it off Lulu and they'll get a printed copy of your book.
You can get a printed copy or you can get a digital copy, whatever your preference is. So we have right now is up there is a printed copy and a PDF copy, and there'll be eventually an EPUB copy. So if you like EPUB, you'll have that too. But what's great about it is, first of all, having worked at a game company where the warehouse was attached, and walking in the warehouse and seeing thousands of books which represented dead trees. It's such a green way to sell books, because it's printed on demand. Because we'd have books that we would eventually wind up never selling because we printed too many and that book didn't do well for some reason. And there's 2,000 copies of books that, you know, what are we going to do with? You know, like the trees are gone. We can't re-tree them, you know, like we can recycle them, but that's the best we can do. So in the case of these print-on-demand services, it's fantastic because... some people don't even, like, I've taken to buying a lot of my books on, like, I've got an iPad, and I read a lot of my books on iPad now.
Yeah, me too.
First, partly that's due to my wife, like, saying, like, we have too many books. We cannot fit any more books in our small New York City apartment. So it's good for that, but it's also green, and I love that. I'm very much into... if you read the book, you'll see, I think, that... and I think I've read some things online about people misunderstanding some of what I want to do with the book. And some of what I wanted to do with the book is make the world a better place. And that's just my own personal opinion. So I've imbued into the book things like, you know, we're talking about, right now we're talking about the business side of it. So I'll just talk about that part of it. But we can talk about the other ones later. But I print on demand. I love print on demand. Like, I don't have an interest in making big print runs. And actually, Lulu will allow you to do like a 1,000 print run if you want to, and it lowers the price. And if that ever becomes a necessity, like I've had some distributors approach me asking if they'd like me to distribute my books. In which case, you need X number of copies. But my questions back to them were, I only want to do it if I can do it in a print on demand way. Meaning, you tell me how many copies you want. I'm only going to print that number of copies because I don't want any copies sitting somewhere. And there's dead trees somewhere. So that's very important to me. So, and in a business point, from business point of view, my main job is being a screenwriter, and that's how I earn my living. So it's a company, it's a legitimate company, you know, it's incorporated and it's a real company. It's not, I don't treat it like it's not in any way. I have got a lawyer for the company, we've got a PR firm for the company, we have a staff for the company. And what's important to me is not making, I'm not a not-for-profit, it's a profit-making company because I want people to buy this book and make a lot of money, I mean, you know, so we can invest in future books. Not for me to make a lot of money. So what I did was two things. One, I made the price point as low as I could. So, in fact, I made it lower than distributors are like, you did how much? Oh, man, like, I don't even know if I can sell that into the hobby market, like, unless you make nothing. So the printed copy of the book, which is about 300 pages, is $19.99. And that's everything you need to play. So in 4th edition, you need obviously a player. Somebody has to have a player's handbook, a DM guide, and a monster manual. Those are the books you need to play. Even if just one person at the table of 5 or 6 buys them or splits it up, that's some, you know, retail price would be like $105. You probably can get it from Amazon for like $75 because they have great deals on Amazon for that. And they're hardcover books, and I'm not taking away, and they're full-color interior. What I decided to do is do softcover, full color exterior, but inside black and white or grayscale.
Very reminiscent of the first edition.
In fact, the size of the book is the exact size of the original Gary Gygax little brown books, and that was a specific homage to him. And actually, I have a great quote from Gail Gygax, who we can talk about screenwriting, but I've been working on a project with her, and she's been very familiar with the game. From the beginning, and she gave me a great quote about how it harkens back to the roots of what Gary was all about. So that was an homage to him. So, but the book is $19.99 for the printed copy, and the PDF and EPUB copies are $9.99, and you get the whole game versus $105, or you know, if you get it from Amazon, $75. So even if you get the deal, $75 versus $20. You know, I'm trying to make it accessible to people in this economy, don't have a lot of money. I mean, a movie, I make movies. Movies are expensive now. And if you go to a 3D movie, you're paying, or I don't know what it is everywhere, but in New York City, I can tell you it's $18. That's almost the price of this whole book, which you can play, only one person needs at the table, and you can play forever. And yes, we're going to have supplements and their expansions onto the game, but honestly, you don't need to buy those. Buy those if you're interested in them, and we're going to keep the price point low on those. So from a business point of view, we want to entertain people. We want people, in fact, we put puzzles all through the book. They're hidden. You have to find them. Some of them are very easy to
Easter
find.
Easter eggs.
They're Easter eggs, and some of them lead you to new information, some of them lead you to free content, and it's something to do between games. So it's not just the book that you pull out when you play your game. In between games, you can play games with it. And also in between games, instead of making it an encyclopedia, we try to make it a fun read. So for example, like we were talking about 4th edition a little bit, and one of the things that I think that was a missed opportunity, even though I think the guys did some really cool things, is the narrative kind of was lost a little bit. And not that it can't be there, it just was in the presentation, it was not there as much as I would like. And what we focused on, we wrote the entire game without the mechanics. Like, I didn't tell the guys I hired, my staff, what the mechanics were. I knew what the mechanics were, but I didn't tell them. I said, here's what I want. I want you to write a chapter. Here is the guidelines for the chapter, and here's what I want you to cover, and here's a sample of what the chapter should read like. Excuse me. And I concentrated on that in every single chapter on three key adjectives. And it was, I want it to be evocative, I want it to be visceral, and I want it to be realistic. Because again, going back to being a hero versus a superhero, I want these things to feel realistic. So I said to one of the guys, look, I'm giving you the gear chapter. I'm like, okay, I know, I'm sure that sounds like it's a boring chapter. I'm just writing sword does a d6 damage, bow, it can shoot this, the range is this. I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write it from the perspective of an old adventurer who's beyond, past his prime, he can't adventure anymore, and he's trying to make his money by selling this gear to player characters. And he may sprinkle in some tall tales of his adventuring career to make these guys think they really need a 10-foot pole. And why, without a 10-foot pole, they're going to die for certain. So he was like, I totally get it. So you can actually read the gear section and enjoy reading it, because there's points where it's funny, and there's points where you're like, oh, that's a good idea. Like, for adventuring, like, I hadn't thought about doing that. And like 10-foot pole, a newer gamer, I think 4th edition gamer, wouldn't necessarily like know what a 10-foot pole represented.
I don't think it's in the equipment list.
I don't even think it's there. So, but if an older player would know, a 10-foot pole was always used to check for traps in front of you. So he talks about that, and like, oh, you can't go on an adventure without a 10-foot pole. Are you crazy? What's wrong with you kids? You need a 10-foot pole, and you tap in front of you, and you look for something hollow, like, and you know there's a trap, or you can use it to reach things that are at your distance that you think might explode, and things like that. And you go, as a player, might go like, oh, I never thought about that. Like, all right, how much is a 10-foot pole? It's, by the way, the whole game is gold pieces. I wanted to simplify everything. So I don't have silver pieces, copper pieces, and what's the math? How many copper pieces do a silver? No, all gold pieces. One gold piece or 10-foot pole? I'll take one. And so it was intended to be an enjoyable read. The spells, for example, and now I've gotten out of talking about the company, but the spells, for example, although no, this is sort of the company because it leads into one other thing I want to say about it. The spells, for example, I had them write it in two sections. One was the description of the spell, and then one was the mechanics of the spell. And I said, don't write the mechanics. Write the description. And when you write the description, it's going to be in second person. I want you to describe not only what we see and what we might hear, I want you to describe how it feels to cast the spell. When you're casting our equivalent of like a web spell, does it feel like 1,000 spiders are crawling all over your body? That's creepy, and evocative and visceral.
And it gives players something to roleplay off.
To roleplay.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did. And then after we had all of that done, once everything was done, then we went back in and I had my stat guys, including me. Like I do both. Because I have a background as a game designer and I have background as a screenwriter and storyteller. So I had the ability, luckily, to be able to do both. And some guys, though, who were more experts in one or the other did brilliant things and things I never would have come up with in their various areas. But I worked on both sides and we created mechanics based on the narrative. So like, okay, this spell sounds really cool. How do I convey that in the mechanics of it? But keep it simple. Keep it simple, but how do I make the mechanics a little bit different? Not just your standard, I roll a d20 and I hit. Okay, the spell works. How do I convey, okay, I'm gonna, oh, I got a great idea. We have a spell called Banish. So, or it's not called Banish actually, but it's like a banishing spell. And what if you, what if there's a chance that, because in the way the spell was written, there was the person who wrote it had described this idea that it was actually known to be a dangerous spell because there was a slim chance that you might accidentally banish yourself into this netherworld, into this great unknown and you could never return from. And I thought that was really cool. Like, it made the spell feel dangerous to cast, like, even if it's a 1% chance. So in writing the mechanics for it, I basically put in a 1% chance that whenever you cast a spell,
you're banished.
You might forbidden, banish yourself into some, great unknown. But it's like, oh, but you get a bonus to whatever your ranks are in the great unknown because you're so familiar with the great unknown that you can prevent that from happening.
Right.
So it all started tying in. So we started it allowed the mechanics to all tie together, not in a mathematical way, but in a narrative way. So it all made sense. So that's kind of how we did it. And the last point I wanted to make about this company is that I had people, because of the internet and digital technology, and we're talking about things like Lulu and Kickstarter, I was able to work with people that I really liked, no matter where they lived. So I put out a call, and actually I knew some people that were game designers that I knew I wanted to work with, but I put out a call for game designers from anywhere and just said, okay, anybody who wants to, who's interested, send me a writing sample, and here's the assignment. And I kept one paragraph, and I want, and do, can, just have to write this in one paragraph. And I got a lot of those in, and I wound up picking people from going, we're in Indianapolis right now, so going west from here, I had people as far away as from Los Angeles, including a person that was, I had been friends with living there, on all the way to England and, in Scotland. Can't put those two together. I'm getting myself into trouble. The United Kingdom, I can say that. So I had people 6,000 miles apart working on the same game, and not only 6 hours apart, but 8 hours apart in time. And the great thing was, we use that to our advantage, and we would say, we in the United States would work on stuff during the day, and then we'd leave notes through this virtual office called, we use this one called Basecamp.
Okay.
It's a virtual office, and I think it's called basecamphq.com for anybody who's interested in taking a look at it. And it gives an area to put files and a message area to talk about things and a whiteboard so you can sit there together and like be talking on the whiteboard. We would leave notes for the guys in the UK, because they'd get up 2 hours later, and they'd be like, okay, and they would take care of that. And so by the time we got up, they had already taken care of it. So we actually could work 24 hours a day.
Very cool.
Which is great. So that, and also getting influences from people, because one of the things that's important to me, again, is making the game global and bringing people together. And I feel like we have technology can be used in good and bad ways, and I think you could look at the internet, for example, as an exaggeration machine. And it can be exaggerated for good in the sense of, like, Haiti has a tragedy and we all want to kick in. Somebody puts up a site immediately and people can donate. Boom, one day.
Yep.
Donations are flowing in. What a great thing. Otherwise, that used to take, days and days, and like money had to be called, sent. It was, now it's like you get your credit card out, you go online, boom, that money is
there.
It's
made people like Jerry Lewis obsolete.
Yeah, in a way, and I hate to say that about Jerry Lewis, but yeah, exactly.
As we saw this weekend, he's no longer with the telethon.
I saw that.
You can do that on the internet now.
You can do it on the internet, which is great and fantastic. But it can be in a negative way, like a lot of people, and I feel like the gaming industry in particular, and it applies to everything, and it's not just about the gaming industry, but because I'm so familiar with it, can apply to the gaming industry too, where it feels very fractured and people can be very, can speak to each other in ways that I know for a fact, going to a lot of conventions, they don't speak to each other that way in person. Like there's this kind of level they feel because of maybe the anonymity.
It's the anonymity.
I don't know what. Yeah, and they would never say that. And I think gamers are better than that. I think gamers are better people than what you often see online. And I hate when people outside our industry go to any game sites and see that, like any forums, let's say. That's not done for the most part on magazines and whatnot, or like on your blog. It's primarily done on message boards and that sort of thing. And I just hate that people think that that's the dominant culture of our industry. It's not. Our industry is a bunch of people. In fact, I believe that our people who are in our industry, gamers, can fix the world. Because gamers are smart. Gamers are problem solvers. Gamers know how to deal with adversity, and gamers know how to work together, and they know how to take advantage of everybody's strengths. What more do you need?
That's true.
And I think we're all great at that, and and it bothers me sometimes, and I had some interactions with people online, and I've slowed down on even bothering because I feel like no matter what I say, it doesn't matter. There's just some disconnect. And, I don't want to be in a negative exchange with somebody who's a fellow gamer, especially. Like, I love gamers. And I think people sometimes don't understand something and those are legitimate questions, and I love to answer those. But when there's things that are, more just negative and let's say, for example, they have a negative opinion about something, about somebody's new game or somebody's a new release from a company, but they haven't read the book. Like, Watch has a new game out, and they haven't read or played the game and or know anything about it, and yet have an opinion.
Yeah,
it's great to have opinions, and your opinions are totally valid, and that's free speech. If you hate the game and you can tell me why you hate the game, great. Tell me. I want to know. Like, that's totally valid, and we should be doing that. But if you haven't played it or experienced it or read it even, I don't understand why. So I've kind of taken myself a little bit out of that, and
It can get very toxic.
It can get very toxic, yeah. And I try to. If there's something that's said that's not true, I try to just. I want to make sure it's said that it. Like, okay, that's not true. Like, people made a mistake or got information wrong. I just want to say no. I just want to let you know that that's like, for example, a dumb thing. Like, if somebody got the price wrong, like, actually, no, it's not 29. It's 19.99. Yeah. Just I did. That's when I try to go on and just say, you know, that's so. You know, it. The internet is great for putting together a team of people who all work together extremely well, 6,000 miles apart.
Yeah,
it's great. I really and that to me made me so. You know, it reversed. I had been getting really down on the internet, and then this brought me way back up on it again.
So let me throw a curveball here, because have two loves in life.
Okay.
Gaming and movies. And writing.
Same here. You've got the. I'm exactly with you.
And I've written several articles on my blog about. I'm a big fan of the 36 dramatic situations.
George Pulitz. Pulse.
Yeah. And I have an article about using the three act structure in your game.
Nice.
So, because I've studied screenwriting.
Great.
That's one of my, and some people know this in my blog and my Twitter stream, and they know that I'm sort of an amateur hobbyist. I love screen, I love it. I work in television, my background's television.
Oh, great.
But I don't do scripted TV, I work in the sports side of television.
Sure.
But, so, as a screenwriter, because you're a working screenwriter.
Yeah.
How do you apply screenwriting at your table when you're DMing?
Actually, you know what? That's just a great question, because that was the impetus for me to design this game. I wanted to take my screenwriting techniques and figure out how do I and I was already a game designer, so I already kind of had knowledge of how to design a game. But one thing I was always missing was, you know, I love, just like you, I love gaming and I love movies. How do I take, and I worked on games like Star Wars, like how do I take the experience of playing the characters and like feeling like I'm telling a story, but without having, as the game master, you know, railroading people. Like, that's not fun, like, to be railroaded. Like, so how do I create, how can I make, what can I do to, you know, I can write into the game, I encourage you to role play, you know, and here are some ideas on role playing. That's not going to make people role play. And I think some people don't role play, not because they hate it, but because maybe they're shy. Or maybe they just have never done it, and I've actually seen, I'll give you an example later, people who don't role play, and then suddenly they in the game, because the way it works, they had to start role playing, and they loved it so much that the rest of the game I couldn't stop this guy. He's just role playing like nuts, like, and he was a real mechanics guy, and he's just role playing, and I was like, he was almost dominating the table with his role playing. Whereas the first half of the game, he was just trying to figure out how to min max and that kind of thing. So it's great. So what I did was this. So first of all, I have to say that I had three great mentors in screenwriting, in TV, and those were Sam Raimi, of course, who is a great storyteller, and he was a head writer of Hercules and Xena, which are two of the shows I worked on, and I worked on another science fiction show, which I don't even want to mention. It didn't do well, and it only lasted one season. It happens. Not all things, we all know that not all movies and TV shows are good.
Part of the business.
So, and then, secondly, I had two great writers, Roberto Orsi, Alex Kurtzman, who were the head writers of Hercules and Xena. Yes, and they did the Transformers movies, they did the Star Trek movie, they did Cowboys and Aliens, which is out right now. They're the producers of The Proposal, they did Friends, they did Hawaii Five-0. Obviously, they're very prolific, and the reason is they're good at what they do. And so I had the great privilege to, you know, have them as mentors. I think three of the greatest storytellers of our time. And I even got to have some exposure to Damon Lindelof through... I wound up working with them in different capacities on the movies.
Oh, you have a credit in Transformers.
I do. I was a transmedia producer, so yeah. I was basically behind the scenes in terms of story, like giving ideas and trying to figure out how can we expand on these ideas to make viral storylines. Because they were really interested in, like, you know, using digital media to kind of make an expanded universe before the movie came out.
Okay.
So we invented, for example, in Transformers 1, we invented Sector 7. And we started putting it into products, Transformers products. Like, I actually wrote a comic book for Transformers, and in there we put a code. And we brought that code to a secret website that you could find in another product. In fact, it was in the trailer, the secret code. But you had to, like, watch the trailer and freeze it right on the right moment to find the website. you could put in that code and it would give you access to what looked like a mainframe. And it was Sector 7's main interior mainframe, and you could start, and it had video, and it had all, you know, redacted paperwork, like you literally like went through with a magic marker, and you could start getting hints about what was in the movie. So they suddenly you were getting Easter eggs. And in fact, the last thing we did was great. We got to, for that movie, we got to, I wrote and we went out and shot three scenes on 29 Palms Marine Base with real Marines, with real Humvees and real helicopters, and them getting attacked in Iraq. It was said, because Southern California like definitely can look like Iraq. Right. So we shot these scenes. It was great. It was, I mean, it was blistering hot, but it was great. So I really got an appreciation, by the way, for the Marines and all of them, the service personnel. I have to say, I just gained it. And my father was in the service too, but to see what those guys go through on a daily basis, I just want to mention that I have a great respect for them. But and they were totally into it. Like, they were spinning Humvees. They're like, we can spin the Humvee? Awesome. And they were, like, doing it and doing all these great things. And they were, like, getting into the acting of it. And these are just, like, 20-year-old Marines. And they were fantastic. So we shoot these scenes. We bring them back. We got the models from ILM for the robots. And we hired a company, visual effects company, to have the robots attacking the Marines. And that the robots then take off, and the Marine gets who survives, like, gets on his, you know, walkie-talkie and says, like, they're heading towards, you know, this direction, and, you know, coordinates. And then if you look up the coordinates, it's Afghanistan, and that's where the movie picks up.
Oh, okay.
Like, literally, it's like from that second, and we released that the day of the movie. Like, the movie opened at midnight on that day, and we released that on that day.
So literally, it was a little prequel to the movie.
It was a little prequel to the movie. So you got to see the robots before anybody else, and you got to see the storyline, like what just happened before the movie started. And so it was like a reward for paying attention to this whole campaign and whatnot. So I did it. I got to, Damon was involved in, and I, in fact, Damon worked on the Star Wars movies as well. So we did the same thing for Star Wars. Star Trek. Got Star Wars on the brain. On Star Trek, and I got to work with him a bit, and I learned a lot from him, like, instantaneously. It was so quick, because his mind worked so fast.
So how do you translate your work to the table, the gaming
absolutely,
table?
Absolutely. I just wanted to give props to those people, because I just feel like I owe them so much. But I could go on talking about that forever. So, and I'm glad that you stopped me. But props to those guys. Thank you, guys. So what I did was I decided, I want people to role play. How do I encourage them to role play? So the first thing I did was I'm going to ignore numbers. I'm going to design the system, and like, I mentioned this before a little bit, but for myself, before I even got these other guys involved, it's like, I'm not going to think in numbers. I'm going to think in literary, I'm going to think in words, let's just put it that way. Okay, so I'm going to have, it's a classic, you got the classic trope, so you've got ability scores. So we call them different names, whatever, but you know, it's like strength and etc. So I'll just pick one, intellect. So instead of saying I have 3 to 18, I'm going to say I have, the top is brilliant, and the lowest is moronic. Okay, and then I have words in, all the way in between, and then the middle is average. And I do that for every single one of them. So for strength, it'd be like mighty all the way down to feeble. For wisdom, it was enlightened all the way down to reckless. And for our version of charisma, which we call presence, it was charming all the way down to repulsive. So I was like, okay, so now when I look at these stats, I start getting a sense of my character, because like, I'm mighty, but I'm moronic. And I'm not reckless. I'm a little bit better than that. I'm foolhardy, but I'm charming. I'm like, okay, I'm starting to get a feel for the character. Not, I have an 18, a 6, a 4, and a 3, and especially for new players who've never played before, they're like, okay, that doesn't help you roleplay.
Right.
You know, but the words help you roleplay. You're like, okay.
I see where you're going. Like, yeah, you're giving them adjectives to play off.
Exactly. Yeah. So I did that for ability scores, and I did that for alignments. So the way I did it for alignments is I have good, very simple, good, neutral, and evil. And you pick what your dominant, what your alignment is, good, neutral, evil. It's on a spectrum, you'll see on the character sheet, and there's tick marks between, and I'll tell you how they come into play. So most people choose good. So let's do a circle good, and underneath each trait, underneath each of the three alignments is a trait associated with that alignment that's part of your personality. So let's just say we've got a knight, and you can roll randomly, or you can select in the whole game. If you know what character you want to play, you make your character. If you want to roll up a random character just for fun to see what comes out and figure out what, who is that, you can do that too. So let's say we're making a character. We know we want to make a character. So I want to have a self-sacrifice. He's a knight. He's good, and he's self-sacrificing. I want that. I'm not sure what I want the other two, the neutral trait, the evil trait. So I'm going to roll and see what comes up with. And, like, neutral. Oh, I got alcoholic. Okay. Okay, that's interesting. That is interesting. I'll keep that. And for evil, I got greed. I'm greedy. Okay, that's interesting. Now, I'm good, though. So I focus on my good trait, which is self-sacrificing, and those other ones are part of me. Because I'm a three-dimensional person, and we all have these tempting things, and, you know, like, it could be anything. It could be, like, I like to overeat, like, you know, or I like to cheat, or not like, I mean, but sometimes we do bad things. Nobody's perfect. So there's these other elements that are part of you. So I was like, okay, great. I've got these descriptors, we call the ones that are associated with the ability scores, and the traits associated with your alignment. So the question is, okay, great. It gives the player an idea of, you know, who this person is. That doesn't make them role play. It's like, it helps them role play, but they could completely ignore that. It's like, okay, well, I need some way that's going to get to encourage them to role play. And I'm not trying, I don't want to force anybody. I'm very much about options and putting the decision making in the hands of the players. I love it when I'm sitting back and the game is going and I don't have to say a word. I love that when I'm the game master for any game. So I need a way to encourage them, especially people who are more tactically oriented, strategic oriented, or, you know, game mechanic oriented, to do it. Because role players are going to role play. They're just going to sit down and role play. And this gives them the clues on how to role play their character. So the second part of it was to, I came up with separately, have your standard, like you were saying, harkening back to kind of the old school days, and I'm working on this project with Gail Gygax right now, which gave me access to all of Gary's original notes on D&D, and the fact that he wanted to be simple and flexible and all these things that he felt like would make a good game. And I always have played first edition, but I've played all the other editions and learned from those. And so I wanted to keep it simple, but I wanted to make it interesting. So original D&D was lacking specific examples of, like, what 4th edition does really well, which is, you know, pushing people, sliding people, like tactical things you can do. Blinding people or whatever. Those are great, like, and it makes you think on a more tactical way. And I loved those about 4th edition. So I was trying to figure out, well, if I were to mash those two up, what would that look like? And I want it in a realistic setting, which I want. So, like, for example, with 4th edition, one of my issues with it was, okay, I have an encounter power. Why can I only do it every 5 minutes? Like, I'm totally fine if that's the mechanic, but I wanted to have it explained to me in a real world, like, why is that the case? And I'll go along with it. Like, cool, just explain to me. But I couldn't figure it out. And one of my house rules was I changed the way encounter powers worked. I won't even go into how it worked, but I just changed it because I couldn't understand it in a realistic way. And I'm sure there is a realistic explanation, but I don't know.
Well, you could always claim the fighter gets tired from doing that one crazy move that's an encounter power.
Yeah.
It exhausts all his strength. There's ways around it.
But what if you have... But you still have your daily powers.
Yes.
You have some strength left, so why... Why can you still pull off your daily? You know that.
You got to be creative in your description.
Exactly. And I did that, and I forced my players to do that. I was like, how do you tell me how you're doing it? So I was basically, well, how do I mash that up and, like, make it very simple and straightforward, and people will get it and not have to work so hard to play? So I came up with a thing called an energy pool. So every day you wake up, and you have an energy pool. It's based on your stats. Doesn't matter how it's cobbled together, but. You start with, let's just say, 10 in a day, and you can use them to do special effects. And special effects are in three different categories. So there's battle, combat related special effects. An example would be blinding somebody. And an example in spell casting special effects would be you realize I'm a wizard, but I need a different spell that I didn't prepare. I used the Vancian system. So I got to rip that one spell out of my mind and stick another spell in there really quickly, and it's very taxing. In fact, I did some research. I did real research on everything. So I read a researcher, because I would notice as a screenwriter, that after a while, I'd be sitting in an air-conditioned room sitting at a desk, just typing, and I'd be sweating. I'm like, why is that? Why am I sweating? And I did some research, it turned out your brain is such a huge organ that it, when you're using it constantly for a long period of time, it needs so much blood because it needs the oxygen that it actually makes you sweat. Because wow. Your blood is coursing through your system so fast. So I was like, okay, so it's taxing to write. And I was like, actually, yeah, I do it. I feel, and I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, when you write, spend a good deal of time writing, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. You can only do it for a certain amount of time, and you're like, I can't do it anymore. I was like, I love that. Okay, so I put that in the game in this way. Like, and it, instead of just being Vancian, it gave you the option to switch your spells out, which a lot of people like. Like, they love the sorcerer from 3rd edition or Pathfinder that gets to pick its spells on the fly. Well, this gives you an option to do that. And by the way, later we'll have a class we call Calling that'll, you know, work on that mechanic from the starting point. But we wanted to have that in there. And the last category of special effects is exploration. The game is very much about the unknown and exploring. So one example from that would be we have to save the princess. We only have a certain amount of time. She's going to be sacrificed. She's in some room in this dungeon. We don't know what the room is. We got to find the room. But it takes 10 minutes to search every room because she's hidden somewhere. So we only have half an hour. And in game time, what are we going to do? And it takes 10 minutes to search each room. Oh, it takes 1 minute to ransack a room and spend some energy points to do it. So, ransacking room, you imagine, you're shoving the bed over, you're knocking things down, you're like ripping closets open, like throwing everything out of it. That takes energy. So you're using your energy points, your pool of energy points. So if, over time, and you're constantly using energy points. It's not just when you get involved in battles, it's all the time. Like double march, we need to move fast or whatever, like, or we need to run away from these people who are chasing us. Let's spend some energy points. It's all the whole party, let's spend some energy points. So they're constantly being used, so they're constantly being depleted. So normally in most RPGs, what I find is the way you regain points is you sleep. Right. So that, I have that. You sleep, you go back to your starting daily amount of allotment of energy points. But like, I didn't want that because that's the 15-minute adventuring day and all that kind of thing. And I was trying to figure out how do I tie that into the role-playing. I was like, okay, I got it. If you every time you role-play a character, you get energy points. So now I've got... If you're Sir Tobias the Knight, who we've been talking about, who's mighty and everything, and self-sacrificing, if you run into like a horde of 100 orcs, let's say, coming down a hill, right at him, and you as the player say, "I'm gonna hold off. I'm a knight and I'm self-sacrificing. I'll hold off the orcs. You all run." Like he's not saying that. He's not talking about this. His actual abilities and all that. He's just saying this in character, like, "I'll hold them off, everybody, you run." And everybody knows that, yes, he's self-sacrificing, he's good, but he's also reckless, and this is crazy. And they try to convince him, no. He's like, "Run, you're wasting time." And they're like, "All right, fine." He's like, "I'll catch up with you." So they all take off, so he saved them. I'm like, 2 points for that. 2 points for role-playing that. And then he's like, "Okay, as the orcs get closer, I scream a battle cry and like call out to my knightly order, which I know the orcs know about, know that has like just decimated orc tribes before, and I'm gonna like run at them for a second, like just run up at them, like being reckless again, and I'm like, "You're gonna get closer to them?" Yeah, I said, "Okay, that's reckless. I'll give you another point for that." So he's like charges at them. And he's like, "All right, now I suddenly stop." And I turn around, and with the points I just earned, I'd run the hell away, and I use from the exploration category, I'm going to use the double march, so I'm going to move at my double speed, because I'm running as fast as I can, and I don't care how many points I got to spend, but I'm going to get out of here. And so he runs up and catches up with the companions who are now safe, and they get away. But it's this moment that the guy who's role-playing his character, he's role-playing his traits, and he's role-playing his descriptors. So suddenly he gets, and he's gaining energy points for doing that. So what happens is, over the course of time, where you really notice is when you have a table full of, and this often happens, you have a table of people, half of them, let's say, are real role players, and half of them are real mechanics people. And the role players are just role playing anyway, so they're doing all these things and accruing all these points, and doing nothing with the points, but they've got them. And the tactical guys are like spending points like crazy. Like, right. I'm gonna.
You have to sort of prod the role players to.
Yeah. Well, and they don't even, because what happens is these guys are like spending their points. And one other thing I didn't mention is, The only caveat to spending energy points is that you have to tell me how you're doing it realistically. Because again, right. back to the realism. So one guy's like, I'm gonna attack this guy and hit a goblin, and I'm gonna blind him. Okay, roll the hit. Okay, all right. So I slash him across the chest, and I blind him. I said, okay, well, you have the points. I know you have the points to blind him, but how are you blinding him? Explain to me how you're blinding him. Oh, I can show you on my character sheet. I carry a pouch of sand. So as I slash across the goblin's chest, I reach into my pouch, pull out a handful of sand, and throw it in his eyes. Like, I buy that. That would work. Okay, you blind him. Oh, done. And so that's the only caveat. So what happens is, that's kind of role-playing a little bit, because it keeps it immersive.
Right.
It's like story. It's not just, I blinded him. Okay, and everybody's like, great, I do this, and that happens, and no one really knows what's happening. No one's visualizing the scene.
Right, no one's seeing what's happening in the game world.
Exactly, and that takes you out. So my idea was, like, the word immersive was always in my mind. So what happens, actually, is the guys who are spending all their points aren't saying to the role players, like, hey, guys, spend your points. What happens is these guys start running out of points, the mechanical guys. And they're like, I want more points. How do I get more points? Meanwhile, the role-playing guys are like, have all these points. And they're like, oh, but these guys are doing some cool stuff. And so they both start noticing, like, okay, well, if I'm a tactical guy, I want more of those points. These guys are getting them by role-playing. Okay, so let me look. Oh, so for example, this actually happened. I had a guy who was about 20, 22 or so, maybe 20, and he was a very tactical guy, and he was great at being a tactical player. So, and by the way, neither of those are good or bad. Role-playing and...
Right.
Those are
different
great.
People play for different reasons.
Yeah, different reasons. So that's all fine and good. What I was trying to do is just bring the people together in a way, you know. So it's not like the tactical people are like going like, no, in three rounds we can take this thing out. But if you run in there first, because you're role-playing, you're going to ruin it. And I've seen fights break out over that. So I wanted them to come together. So this guy says, let me look at my... my character's moronic. She says, all right, here's what I want to do. It's my turn on that. We have different names for, you know, everything, of course, and it works differently. But we had, like, essentially the idea of a wall of fire. He's like, the wizard just cast a wall of fire. They're fighting a tree ant who's on the other wall side of the wall of fire. But the wall of fire missed the tree ant, so it didn't light up the tree ant. So he goes, I've got a great idea. I'm going to go stand in the wall of fire until everything is burning, and then I'm going to jump on the tree ant. It's made of wood. And everyone's like, no, you're going to burn up. You can't do that. Like, you're going to take tons of damage. Don't do that. And he's like, no, what you don't understand is it's magical fire. And then he walks off, and they're like, okay, that's moronic.
And he burns.
And he does. He walks into the wall of fire. I'm like, okay, you tell me. He's like, I want to make sure I'm good and on fire. I'm like, tell me when, and I'll keep rolling damage. He's like, okay, that sounds good. Am I really good and on fire? I'm like, you're really good and on fire, and you're in unbelievable pain. He's like, okay, perfect. He's like, I yell out in pain, and I jump onto the tree end. So he's got to make his attack roll, and he does, and he says, I jump on a dagger first. So he jumps up, and he rolls a natural 20, and I've got critical successes and failures, and they work basically the same way, but it double damage. It's not, you know, it doesn't work in fourth edition way, it's more of an old school way, and he does double damage. So, okay, so you do double damage with your dagger, and you're a thief, so you do quadruple damage, because you sneak attack, because it couldn't see you through the wall of fire, and because you're on fire, and it's a tree... you're going to do a lot more damage, so I'm going to have you roll two extra 2d6 dice of damage on the tree. And he said, wait a minute, I want to use a special effect, and I want to do extra damage to the tree. I'm like, all right, well, how are you going to do that? He's like, I'm going to let gravity pull me down. I'm like, let the dagger loose a little bit, so it slides. I slide down the tree, and I light up more branches on fire while I'm still on fire.
That's creative.
Yeah, it's creative. And I said, I buy that. So I'm like, okay, so roll your extra damage. And so we wind up doing, in the game here, people are doing anywhere from 5 points of damage to 12 points of damage, like on an average. And he did 48 points of damage to this thing. But he took, like, you know, 15 points of damage, and the game is very lethal. So you don't have a lot of what are the equivalent of hit points. It's wound. It's actually, you'll often be familiar, it's wound levels,
right, like Star Wars. Like Star Wars was.
But you've got... tick marks, you can have a certain number of, you get a certain number of, we call them stamina points per level, per wound level. So let's say you have four. So there's five levels and you have four. I mean, basically you have 20 hit points.
Right.
But as you tick down to wound levels, like in Star Wars, we had a penalty. We were accruing penalties to your attack rolls and whatnot. I didn't want to do a straight version of that, and also I didn't want to rip off any game. even though mechanically you can't copyright anything, I still didn't want to do that. What I did was I tried to make it interesting. So at one point, one of the names of the wound levels is messed up.
That's so funny.
So when you're messed up, your criticals become, a successful critical hit becomes 15 to 20 instead of just 20, but critical failure becomes 1 to 5 instead of 1. Because you're just flailing around, right. And like, you know, you might chop off the head of the enemy, but you might chop off your friend's head. Like, you're just flailing around because you're going down. And you're just going wild. You might want to step out of the fight. So I try, it's not just penalties, and it's not just, oh, I add a plus 1 now, and I add a plus 2 now, and wait, how many pluses am I at, and where, how many, I tried to make it different, so it was interesting.
Well, it definitely sounds like you're passionate about your game, and
I'm very, very passionate about
gaming.
That. And about game, I love games, like, yeah. Just like you.
I mean, we could probably sit here and talk for 5 hours about games and movies.
We could, but I think to answer your question, that's how I was able to integrate these two things, and I'll just give one quick example of it, because I've been talking about positive things in the game. We had a guy who, an example would be, we'll go back to the knight, make it really quick. He's got this greedy trait. I say, you find this sword in a hidden compartment, only you've seen it. And all the magic items, and we call them talismans, in the game are unique. And we have tables to roll on to make them unique. That, you know, they look a certain way, they might have weird qualities in, like, their light, you know,
are they named? List. Are the magical items named?
You give them names, it's histories, who's used them, all these ideas. So I say, you see this sword and you recognize it because it's got these symbols on it, whatnot. You recognize it as the Great Sword of the North. You knew that's part of your order, and you think you can do a lot of good with it. But you're a knight, and you're noble, and you're good, and you think you should give it to show it to the party first. And I'm going to play the tempter because you have this evil trait of greed in you, and you think you could do a lot of good with it. So I start a negotiation, and I say, I'll give you 5 energy points if you go to your greedy nature and take the sword. We negotiate, and he's like, no, I'm too good for that. I'll give you 10 points. 10 energy points to take this. And I'm playing that tempter.
Right, you're tempting. You're the devil on his shoulder.
Exactly, yeah. Devil on the shoulder. That's a great way of putting it. And you're like, okay, I'll do it. But in doing it, he ticks 1 on the alignment spectrum towards evil because he did his evil trait.
Got it.
So eventually he could get himself booted out of his order for being evil and have to go on a quest of redemption. So that was the other way,
Very cool.
And the last thing I'll say about the game, just in total in general, was one of the incentives for me is bringing people together who play every kind of a game, but especially every kind of edition of D&D, and have a good time. And I've had experiences with the playtesting where I had people at the table who were vehemently for or against the game come away saying, you know, I just had a great time, and like, I forgot that I wasn't playing my regular version of D&D. And it's great to go keep playing Pathfinder because you love it, but when you want to get together with some friends who don't play Pathfinder, or like, you know, some people get adamant about it, you can, this will be, and somebody said a great line, which I can never use, which, this is like the universal translator for D&D. I was like, okay, I'll be sued by Star Trek and Hasbro, like, on that one. So, but I think that sums up the game. It's fast, it's flexible, it's only $19.99 for the whole game, it encourages role-playing, but it not only encourages it, but encourages it through mechanics that are fun to do, so it appeals to both types of gamers.
I would love to sit here and talk games and movies all day, but unfortunately here at Gen Con, we only have so much time.
That's true.
I want to thank you for taking the time
talking to me. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Really nice having this chat, and I hope the game does well, and I'm going to put a link out on the blog so people
can
find it.
Great, and actually, for anybody who's, because if you're coming from my blog, check out Enrique's blog. It's fantastic.
NewbieDM.com.
NewbieDM.com. It's awesome. So everybody who came from my site, please go look through it, and you'll love it.
All right, thank you, George.